means of measuring what impedance the tip of it is presenting to the ground plane. And what was the size of the ground plane we're using? I'd like to believe the ground plane was not a big variable. If I know you, you were using a 1 square yard sheet of metal as the ground plane. Is that approximately right, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I was just using a very, very large ground plane. It was at least 36 inch square, and just measuring with this, and very, very surprising results. I was expecting the bandwidth to get narrower, and seeing that the bandwidth went wider, it was kind of a shock. And as I said, I'm not sure if that's because of the capacitive coupling in between, but I think you're right. I'm going to have to really spend a little bit more time investigating the bottom piece, but. You know, that's what I'm saying. I just wanted to run it by you. Does it really sound feasible that it's really and truly giving me more bandwidth? Because there, it's leading me to believe that that maybe there's something here. You know, to you know, making a collinear dual stack. Originally, the way this company Optek did this, and I've actually just by making small modifications to what they originally had, and actually improved the antenna quite a bit. And you know. Kind of surprised by this, but to see that actually I could make a dual band antenna that pretty much covers most of the whole 2 meter and 70 centimeter band. That was quite shocking to me, Dick. Back to you.
If I understand correctly, Glenn, your base loading device, feeding device, was mechanically made to support a dual band antenna. That means it was feeding one end of an antenna that worked on, let's say, 146 megs and then 450 megs. So therefore, it is more than just a simple number of turns with a tapped 50-ohm coax cable coming into it across one of the turns. I suspect that that base thing, because it's operating on two separate bands with a 3-to-1 frequency range between them, there's a lot more in that base than first meets the eye. It's not just a simple coil with a tap. I think you're going to find other little doodads in there. So that's also part of the variable here. If you give a guy enough inductors, capacitors, shorting turns, coils, and whatever in the base, he can force an antenna to be more broadband. There's all kinds of ways of doing that. Most of them are lossy, but some of them can be lossless. So you're going to have to really investigate what that base is, because that's part of the equation. You thought that you were just feeding the base of an antenna and all the impedances you were seeing was the antenna itself. Well, because the antenna is not at its base a 50-ohm device, it's something more like 1,000 or 1,500 ohms for a simple half wave, and now you're making a more compound reactor in the center type half wave. There's no simple answer. What else is new? Life is not simple, is it, Glenn? Over to you, K2RIW. Looking forward to your further investigations. You're on to something good here.
I think, Dick, you nailed exactly what I was suspecting, that it's in that base piece on the bottom where basically this is taking place, that, in other words, between, if they're probably using inductors and capacitors inside that bottom base, and which is a little bit more lossy. Because one of the things I've noticed in some of the original documentation for both antennas, the one from Diamond was just a dual band, and then the Optek, which was a dual band but dual stacked. The one thing I've noticed is that, and compared to my standard dual band antenna that I have with an NMO mount, the standard dual band NMO mount can handle a lot more power, in which it can handle up to, like, say, 200 watts, but it's limited to, it's limited to a much narrower bandwidth. And these antennas that have more bandwidth are limited to, let's say, like 125 watts max. So I think you're onto something here in the matching network. I've got to probably do a little bit more investigation on that bottom half matching and see what's really going on in there, because that's probably the key to this newfound bandwidth in these antennas. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
Yep. Makes sense. But as you're discovering, there's only a nearly infinite number of ways of making an antenna. The antenna engineering handbook will show you, depending on how you count them, close to 5,000 antennas in my book. And people will disagree with me as to whether or not antenna A and antenna B really are a different antenna. And you could almost take that number and double it once you start using Babinet's rule. You'd be amazed how many students come out of a good electrical engineering college where they've studied RF engineering and they got a bachelor degree, and you're interviewing them, and you ask them, of all the antennas in the world there are, what's your guess as to how many? And they come up with numbers like, oh, there's probably about 30 different ways you can bend pieces of wire and make an antenna out of it. They're only 2.5 orders of magnitude low from the real number. Very similar to what happens when you ask people what is the mass of a cubic meter of air, the stuff that's in the room with you right now. You'd be amazed how many people will guess a milligram. And the answer is 1.2 kilograms. They're 1.2 million times low. I mean, as a gut feel as to what's happening with air. You can see how a lot of misunderstanding can happen. You may have heard a quick discussion I had a couple of days ago on this repeater, because you do quite a bit of listening, I'm guessing. I recently discovered how much true sound power creates the threshold of pain. If you go to the reference data for radio engineers and you look at the acoustic section, a threshold of pain is called 95 decibels. 95 decibels stronger than the threshold of hearing, you're at the threshold of pain. So 95 decibels stronger than threshold can be expressed as a certain number of acoustic milliwatts per square centimeter. So if I'm directly applying that number of milliwatts per square centimeter, threshold of pain, by way of an earplug directly into an ear canal of a human being, and the ear canal of a human being is very close to a cross-sectional area of 1 square centimeter. So it figures. So it's well known the amount of power required in watts of acoustic power per square centimeter to create threshold of pain. And if you're creating that exact amount of power into an ear canal by way of an earbud, what's your guess as to the amount of power? You're going to give me an answer in microwatts, milliwatts, watts, kilowatts, you know what I mean. How much power in watts per square centimeter applied directly to an ear canal of a human being is at the threshold of pain? Give me a gut feel on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, there's a lot. This is a very, very confusing thing because you have a lot of these sound pressure measurements are typically like for a speaker. An SPL level is measured, you know, like say 90 decibels with 1 watt at 1 meter. When you're at directly inside the ear canal with just the length of the ear canal to the eardrum, and with the amount of air pressure just within the ear, you're probably into the sound pressure in watts at that particular time. I'm not sure directly how that conversion works. So I'd have to think about that one. But I would imagine it's probably to the -6 microwatts, Dick.
And you've given a much better answer than the average person. Quite often I hear an answer of 1 watt. And they're going on the fact that every handheld transistor radio can put out, a watt of audio into its loudspeaker. Every hi-fi in your living room can put out 100 watts if it's a good one, and so on. Some of the hi-fis that people put in cars are multiple hundreds of watts, and they don't realize what the conversion efficiency is. Part of the confusion, very similar to what goes on with magnetics, where you can measure things in Gauss and kilogauss and Oersted and Teslas, and there's a zillion units for magnetic fields and magnetic flux densities and whatever. Confusing as all hell to a neophyte. By the same token, sound pressure is usually measured in dynes or newtons per square meter, pascal. They usually measure sound pressure. Well, if you want to do a conversion to an electrical engineer, sound pressure in acoustics is equal to voltage in electronics. So sound pressure, if it's RMS, is equal to volts RMS. Power is a function of E squared over R. So pressure squared over R, the impedance of air, gives you watts. Well, you're about to say, what is the impedance of air? It's a crazy set of units. 416 pascal seconds per meter cubed. What does that turn out to? 416 ohms. You can assume that air at standard temperature, pressure, whatever, has an impedance of 416 ohms. You can assume that the pressure in pascal is volts, and now by E squared over R, you know power. And so to convert from pressure to watts of acoustic repeater,
Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
To convert from acoustic pressure, which is the most often used units, into sound volume, sound intensity. Intensity is the right word to use. Acoustic intensity is really watts per square something. Watts per square meter, watts per square centimeter. It turns out that the threshold of hearing is minus 160 pascals per square meter. No, minus 160 watts per square meter, which turns out to be minus 120, I think it is, watts per square centimeter. Minus 120 watts per square centimeter is the threshold of hearing. 95 decibels above that, I believe, is 2 milliwatts. Or 93 decibels, I think it is. Anyhow, the answer for threshold of pain is approximately 1 milliwatt. 1 milliwatt of acoustic power, 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, directly into the ear canal, you're at the threshold of pain. You take an iPod 5G music playing device. It has an electronic power output of 2 times 30 milliwatts. Each individual channel, left channel and right channel, can put out 30 milliwatts. 1 milliwatt into your ear canal of acoustic noise power is at the threshold of pain. That means if your earplugs have a conversion efficiency from electrical signal to acoustic intensity, if their conversion efficiency is anything more than 3%, then that iPod is capable of creating ear damage if you misuse it in the worst way. Those to me are kind of amazing numbers. KC2 QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I haven't seen recently, but I know that for a while there, like when Walkman were becoming popular, there were warnings on the headsets and a lot of those portable devices that were warning people that, you know, that those devices can definitely cause ear canal damage. There were warnings. You know, lately I don't think I've seen too much of that because I know I've bought some hands-free headsets for, like, my cell phones, and now everything's like MP3. So I'm listening to a lot of music now with my phone itself. But I haven't really seen those warnings in a while, but I would hope that they're still out there, Dick, because, yeah, you only get one set of ears in life, and once they're damaged, it's a problem. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
You know that the human hearing is a little bit less sensitive at 20 hertz. Human hearing supposedly goes from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz when you're a young person. An average age person, you're in my age, we don't have a lot of response beyond 5 or 10 kilohertz. That fell off from the time we were 16 years of age. When I was 16 years of age, 18 years of age, doing television repair, I could walk into a home and the horizontal oscillator on the television sets running at 15, 750 hertz, I could hear that squeal. I could walk through the front door of a home. I could tell you how many television sets were on and which rooms they're in by standing at the front door. Can't do that anymore. I have essentially no response beyond 10 KC anymore, maybe even beyond 8 KC. But the lower frequencies you tend not to lose. So whether you're a young or an old person, and you're comparing the sensitivity of a human ear to sound intensity, and you decide to compare 20 hertz response versus 2 kilohertz. So the bottom end of the acoustic range where human hearing keeps working, you don't lose that. So 20 hertz and 2 kilohertz, unless you've done something bad and you're very old, you don't lose that. So if I'm comparing 1 or 2 kilohertz, where you're most sensitive, down to 20 hertz of an average human ear, what's your guess as to the difference in sensitivity in decibels? Give me a rough guess.
This is a rough guess and at best. I would say it's probably somewhere around 30 dB across the hearing range.
That's about what I would have guessed. You look at the Fletcher-Munson curve, you can get a hold of them in reference data in a whole lot of other places. 20 hertz, the average person is 80 decibels less sensitive than you are at 1 or 2 kilohertz. 80 decibels near the threshold of hearing for a weak signal. As it gets stronger, your hearing becomes a little bit flatter. But for a threshold signal, a measuring threshold at 2 kilohertz and then a measuring threshold at 20 hertz, 80 decibels of difference. Maybe it's 78, but I call it 80 decibels. That's amazing. All of a sudden, you now suddenly realize that if you're pouring tones into a loudspeaker and you're watching that loudspeaker. I used to be very confused by this one. At 2 kilohertz, I'm watching that loudspeaker, and it looks like it's not moving at all. I put my hand on it, I can barely tell that it's moving, and I'm hearing a lot of 2 kilohertz sound come out of it. I turn the signal generator down to 20 hertz, and I turn up the volume until it sounds about equally loud to me, and I'm looking at that cone, and it's almost moving at the limits of its extent before it's slamming against the walls, if you know what I mean. I couldn't understand why the loudspeaker had to move a whole lot at low frequencies compared to high frequencies. I thought there's something very nonlinear about air causing that. Assuming the loudspeaker is big enough that it can reproduce those low frequency notes, I now know what's going on. The majority of it is not the loudspeaker, it's not the air, it's the human hearing. And I missed the point for all of these years, until recently. W. Glenn, KQRIW.
Believe it or not, that much I knew. Yeah, your hearing is really depends on a lot of how you want to shape sound and why there's actually such a big difference between what one person considers a quality stereo sound versus another person. And, you know, it's not so much just taste or whatever. It's actually quality of hearing. Depending on how good your hearing is or how poor your hearing is, is going to depend on what kind of sound reproduction system is going to be acceptable to you. So it's a very, very interesting topic, and audiophiles have been arguing this one for ages, Dick. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
Yeah, when it comes to how linearly your amplifier reproduces various notes, how well your sound system, also efficiency of loudspeakers, you got a big rub when it comes to loudspeakers. There are loudspeakers that are very flat in response. They got a real good bass reflex or whatever kind of mounting structure that they're in. Baffle. They got a real good baffle structure. If you don't have a baffle, the sound coming around from the back of the loudspeaker folds around to the front and partially cancels. You got to have a baffle of some kind. It's got to work through a wall. But loudspeakers that are flat are rather low in efficiency. Loudspeakers that are high in efficiency, I've got peaks and valleys all over the place in their response. I suspect many of the quality hi-fi loudspeakers have efficiencies in the vicinity of 5 and 8%. Have you ever heard numbers like that before, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that I've ever really heard speakers, you know, when people talk about it, actually efficiencies other than SPL ratings. In other words, usually efficiency is like a very, very loosely confederated term. It's usually like you'll see a power level driven into the speaker at 1 meter and an amplitude level at 1 meter. So like, okay, 1 watt at 1 meter away from the speaker at a certain frequency will give you, let's say, like a 90 dB SPL, which is kind of like an average efficiency for a speaker. Very, very high. Like there was a manufacturer called Klipsch or Klipsch Horn at one time, and they had the highest efficiency of all the speakers. And actually, I believe the Klipsch Horn had at 1 watt at 1 meter a relatively flat 110 dB output of noise sound pressure at 1 meter. And the lowest efficiency speaker that I ever heard of was actually a speaker called the Magnaplaner, an electrostatic speaker. And a very, very flat frequency response, the flattest probably ever, but it had an efficiency, I think, at 1 watt at 1 meter of about an 80 dB SPL level. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Once again, for 1 watt, one of them was 80 dB SPL, and what was the other one, 90-something?
The Magnaplaner, or the Magnapan speakers, which are electrostatic, were 1 watt, 80 dBA SPL. So that was the Magnaplaner electrostatic, and the highest efficiency I've ever heard of at a speaker was the Klipsch Horn, which was 110 dBA SPL at one watt and 1 meter. KC2QIQ.
KC2IKK with comment.
IKK recognized. Okay, so I'm hearing the two numbers now, 80 and 110. 30 decibels of difference, 1,000-to-1 ratio of electric power input versus acoustic output. And the acoustic output is being given to you in units that the average person, he knows how to compare brand A to brand B. One's got a bigger dB over the other, and those dBs are almost always dBs above threshold. But when they give you 80 dB SPL, sound pressure level, they're telling you the volts. And it's, I guess you could call it the equivalent of volts per meter. They're not really telling you watts per square meter, but you can convert. IKT, I think it was. Hey, you know who you are. Give me your call. That isn't your name. Go right ahead, sir. K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Sure. Thanks, Dick. This is WB2IKT. Name is George. And just a comment. I own the MagnaPan speakers, and I've used them for many, many years very successfully. Glenn, you're right. They are not very, very efficient, but they're not quite as inefficient as you stated. Also, they're not electrostatic in any way. There's no electrostatic component to them. They are the equivalent of what we call a ribbon speaker. What they have is a printed circuit grid on a Mylar foil, or on a Mylar film, that has a conductive trace. The speaker frame is made of opposing perforated magnets. And when you put power into the foil that's on in between the two grids and tension, the thing moves back and forth. That's what makes it move. Very, very flat in its frequency response. Very, very smooth. There's no peaks and dips. You're much fewer of them than in a boxlet speaker. But the efficiency of these things, and that's what we're talking about here, is probably in the area of about 83 dB SPL. So hopefully that can shed a little bit of light on it. Not quite as inefficient. Also, Klipsch made a very efficient speaker for sure. But Altec Lansing actually made Voice of the Theater speakers, which were substantially more efficient than the Klipsch ones. The larger ones that they actually put into movie theaters were extremely efficient. But even so, tops I've ever heard for a speaker efficiency was something on the order of 5%. MagnaPans are probably on the order of less than 10%. Take back to that. This is WBIKT.
Wow, George, that's an eye-opener. You're saying there are loudspeakers, respected brand names, where the conversion efficiency from electrical energy to acoustic intensity is less than 1%. I think you said a tenth of a percent? Wow. Over to you, George, for a repeat on that.
That's correct. Loudspeakers are... electromagnetic-type loudspeakers are just not very efficient at all. The ones by Magnaplaner, and Glenn was absolutely right, they are terribly inefficient. They suck up a lot of amplifier power, but in return for that inefficiency, you get extremely smooth sound, and musicians tend to really like them. So, back to that.
Wild. Wow. Now, inefficiency. Essentially, in this environment that we're now discussing, the only method of inefficiency is loss, resistive loss. The electrical energy you're putting into it, some of it is going into acoustic energy and comes blasting out of the loudspeaker as if it was an antenna transmitting a signal into air, but in this case it's acoustic energy into air, but there's a strong similarity between the two, even though one's a transverse wave and the other's a longitudinal wave, a pressure wave, but still, there's a lot of similarity. If the speaker is running at less than 1% efficiency, which I could invert the numbers and say it's 99% inefficiency, that means if I put a watt into the speaker, 10 milliwatts gets converted into audio, 990 milliwatts gets converted into heat. If I'm continuously running 30 watts of music into this loudspeaker, I'm creating 29.9 watts of heat, so to speak. I've never heard anybody talk about loudspeakers running hot and you have to put a fan on them, so something doesn't quite ring true here. Over to you for a comment on that one, George. K2RIW.
K2RIW, the group WB2IKT. It's not at all uncommon for speakers to overheat, burn out voice coils, and so on. One tends to see that a lot on tweeters. Most tweeters can really not take a whole hell of a lot of power, and they burn up relatively easily. But even heavy-duty woofers, when you put them on rock music and the electronic music that a lot of people seem to like. And listen to it at Richter scale power levels. loudspeaker burnouts and actual cones catching on fire from the power in the voice coil is not uncommon, believe it or not. Those are well-known faults as speakers for heavy-duty services.
KC2, QIQ with a comment?
You got it, Glenn.
I think you're more on the money, Dick, with home listening use. Like we were talking about before, you know, okay, we'll say, okay, some of the least efficient speakers are going to be in the low 80s SPL levels, and your highest of anywhere are going to be like 110. You know, measure with a micrometer, cut it with an axe. Your average speaker system for, you know, for a relatively quality stereo home system is going to be around the 90 dB SPL level, give or take. And now, if you figure that the average listening level, even moderately loud, is going to be at a 1 watt level. I mean, if 1 watt is going to give you 90 dB SPL at 1 meter, you can imagine that even doubling the power to 2 watts, that's a 3 dB increase, 6, 10 watts, you're going to have a lot of sound pressure inside a, you know, inside a home listening area. When you start getting into large theaters and into outdoor bins and boxes that bands would use or extremely large PA systems, power efficiency and dissipation in speaker boxes becomes paramount, Dick, and it really is a serious problem. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, now I've got another problem. We seem to be obeying conservation of energy. Watts of electrical power input versus acoustic intensity coming back out. And we're sort of accepting these rather low efficiency numbers. I mean, you and I would never use an antenna with 1% efficiency. What if it had 99% efficiency?
It doesn't have that kind of bandwidth and octaves, Dick.
I accept that. Although, there are antennas that are rather broadband, but still they don't run anywhere near this low in efficiency. Huh. The point I was going to make, what's the mechanism? Is it the resistance of the voice coil? The resistance of the wire? Is that where it's being lost? Where's 90-some-odd% of the power being lost? It's being turned into heat. Where? The voice coil is the first thing that we see burn up. So is it resistance of the wire in the voice coil? And can't we use bigger neodymium magnets and larger gauge of wire? Yeah, the larger gauge of wire has got more mass, and it's more difficult to move it fast for the higher frequencies. I see where we're going here. Broadband, high-frequency response requires very light moving coils. Light moving coils are very small gauge wire. Very small gauge wire has got a lot of resistance. I'm slowly accepting it's the resistance of the wire. What do you think, Glenn?
I believe that's the majority of the case in terms of the drivers themselves, that you know, the resistance of wire is certainly an area for high dissipation. Also, there's eddy current losses in between the windings of these coils and the magnets. So there again, it's another RAC type of loss, and it's back to the wire again. So yeah, there's more loss there. But there's another thing too. Crossover networks are typically very lossy. When you try to get that flat response between multiple mismatched drivers and try to get the phase response to, you know, line up somewhat along a front facial plate for a speaker driver in different locations, there's a lot of resistances that are placed in the crossover networks to try to balance everything out, Dick. So there's a lot of losses in the crossovers as well.
Okay. If you want real high fidelity, flat frequency response, if you want it to sound like a real theater or a real auditorium with an orchestra in it, I guess we have to live with these inefficiencies. And since electrical circuitry that can produce these kind of powers these days is not expensive, and we're not burning up a whole lot of electricity as far as Con Ed and LIPA is concerned, I guess it's all acceptable. And there's no simple way around all this. I still keep remembering that New York City Marathon, 15 or 20 years ago, one of the contributors to the marathon wanted to supply music to the runners. So on First Avenue, at around 50th Street, as I remember, 60th Street, 70th Street, wherever we were, was this flatbed truck. The flatbed looked like it was about 40 feet long. On it were some huge theater speakers and very high power amplifiers. And this DJ group was playing that song Hot, Hot, Hot. And they were playing it at seismic levels. I know when I walked 2 blocks away from them, up street or down street, uptown or downtown, the loudness of what those guys were doing. I could feel the vibration through the macadam of the street. Wow. And those guys, day in and day out, doing that music business, are right alongside of those loudspeakers, and they were not wearing ear protection. Their hearing must be really heavily damaged. KQQIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it is interesting, Dick, and too, if you notice, a lot of professional bands, the speakers are always arranged towards the audience, and one of the key things with a PA system and focusing the sound is in front of the musician to try to protect them. A lot of musicians do actually use earplugs whenever possible to protect their hearing, and there's another thing, too. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but if you look at a live stage many times, there's a speaker that actually points back at the musician, and it's called a monitor speaker. And the reason there is because so that they can hear themselves over and above the PA, they actually focus the sound back at themselves through a separate monitor speaker. Because otherwise, between all the background noise and the PA and everything else, sometimes it's almost impossible for them to hear their own performance. And some professionals actually use some kind of a hearing device, like a headphone or an ear insert, so that they can actually hear their voice or their instrument outside of the live performance. So live performance is a very, very crazy thing, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
As I read more about this, and as I was talking to Eric, I guess it was last week or 2 weeks ago, when you set up an auditorium for a really good sound system, and the auditorium is very long, you got to worry about the amount of time it takes for the sound to spread from the stage to the back of the room. You have to put delay circuits into the loudspeakers that are in the back of the room. That sound has to be delayed electronically so that the people in the back of the room are not hearing an echo effect, you know, where they hear a little bit of the sound directly from the stage and hear some of the sound directly from the loudspeaker near them, and those two have to be in coherence. So all kinds of crazy acoustic delay circuits are required to make this all come out right. So properly tuning a room to get good acoustics, there's quite an art and science to that, I guess. And I guess a person using binoculars or opera glasses in the back of the room is going to be hearing the sound. He's going to think it's pretty nice. He puts on his binoculars. He looks at the voice. He looks at the lips of the person doing the singing and talking and whatever, and realizes the great big time delay between the two. KQRIW listening to anybody who wants to talk.
WGB.
You got it, John.
What Glenn was saying is absolutely right about crossovers. They're power suckers. That's why most of the bands, and a lot of home stuff too, I had two 30-inch JBL speakers that were in my bass system. But they have an amplifier for each set of frequencies they want to control. So like on the big JBL 30 inches, we use Crown or GWs at 1,000 watts. And all of that network mixing was done before the amplifiers, and you only fed the low signals to one group of speakers and others, because when you put that into crossovers at those powers, you just smoke them up. So those JBLs were flat wound, ribbon wound voice coils, and the spiders are actually perforated to allow the air to flow into the magnet area to cool them, because they would get so hot you couldn't touch them.
You almost have to put a heat sink and a fan on the crossover network about that, or on the loudspeakers themselves. Huh. Interesting stuff. Different than common sense. And so many people will read SPLs of a loudspeaker measured at 1 meter for some number of watts of input at some particular frequency, and compare brand A to brand B in flatness and efficiency and whatever. But I suspect very, very few people know how to convert an SPL which is in pascals per square meter. Oh, it's in pascals, period. It's in units of pascals, that's newtons per square meter of sound pressure level. To convert that into watts of acoustic energy, I'll bet you very few people know how to do that. A few of them know what book it's contained in, but very few people know how to do it. By the same token, when it comes to magnetic measurements of, say, for instance, a transformer design, not very many people know how to convert the raw data for the materials you can buy for the EI laminations of the transformer versus how big should the air gap be and how many turns and what will be the primary inductance and so on and what will be the amplitude of saturation at what frequency. Not many of us know how to do that. These are individual arts and sciences. Let's go back to where you are with your seismometer. Kind of curious what the next step is going to be, John. Well, I think as you read that picture on that sailboat-like seismometer, I think it's going to give you a whole lot of ideas for improvement in performance and simplification of design. Looks like that kit that you can buy that does that sailboat-like design looks to me like it's been around for a long time.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It looks to me like it's gone through quite a few levels of refinement, and I think they've got it down to a very basic, very little wasted material, wasted energy, quite an effective device. Not elegant. I mean, the real elegant ones look like a, you know, an oil drum that you sink in the ground. But for what you're trying to do, maybe that's adequate. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, if you look at the original seismographs that were built, I believe, early part of the 20th century, they were that basic same thing, little triangle. At the end of the triangle was a massive steel ball with like a pen sticking out of the bottom on a piece of paper. And that's how they worked. So basically, that hasn't changed much. But I wanted to ask you before you leave what the website, or I can go to Google seismic. But seismic what?
I googled the word seismometer. Seismometer gave that to me. The third item, you can tell right away on the way Google responds that the third item is a bunch of miniature photographs that when you, there's about four of them horizontally displaced, miniature photographs, and as you click on each one of them, it expands, and you'll immediately see that sailboat design just by googling the word seismometer. Over to you, John.
Exactly what I'm going to do tonight, or this morning, I should say. I'm going to take a look at that. Also, I'm going to try to get those photographs that you suggested. I'll get a copy over to you so that as soon as I take them, so that you can basically, I know, you know, the picture's worth a thousand words, and then you'll be able to see exactly what's going on.
Yeah, this idea of the sailboat design with the horseshoe magnet. My gut feels the horseshoe magnet, as it moves across that pancake coil, it's moving radially across the pancake coil. I can picture in my mind how the magnetic lines of frost across the tips of the horseshoe are cutting across those lines of copper and really giving you great sensitivity. And it doesn't have to be a super strong magnet. An old-fashioned horseshoe Alnico magnet will do it, in my opinion. The magnetic strength, I don't think, is your limiting factor. Your natural resonant frequency, I think, is one of the things that's eventually going to be something you're going to want to improve on. So if you start off with a big enough sailboat, you're there. And with that that oil pot, dash pot damping structure, with all of its tunability, allows you to choose whatever damping factor you want. And as I said before, Damping requires heat. Whatever your damping mechanism is, it must convert motion into thermal energy, heat. That's the only way you get loss. A damping structure is a lossy structure. A shock absorber on a car got to get hot when you drive over a rough road. And when you're sloshing that oil in the pot of the dash pot, you're stirring the oil and in theory you're creating heat. And that gives me a little bit more of a feeling for why A ball of cotton won't do it. The mechanism creating heat in the ball of cotton, the cotton is springy, but it may not be creating very much heat. I will admit that hysteresis damping, magnetic damping, that does also create heat, particularly if you do it with a resistor loading or if the eddy currents are creating the equivalent of shunt resistors. So you got to think heat when it comes to damping. And ultimately, you intend to, in fact, they made it clear in some of those articles that when you just simply Google the word seismometer, they make it fairly clear that these designs that they're showing you, one design with a particular frequency response, natural frequency response, can easily detect an earthquake 30 kilometers away, and you go a little bit more sensitive and a little bit lower in frequency, and you can detect an earthquake of more than magnitude 4.5 anywhere in the world. And so it'd be sort of nice for you to see these earthquakes on your own instrumentation in your own laboratory. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, right now I've recorded a lot of seismic activity. Where it is and what it is, I don't know yet, but there's ways of finding that out, too, with critical timing. But, you know, another thing I was going to ask you, the dash pot that you're talking about, the oil, was it a straight rod hanging down with like a mushroom on the end, or was it a vein on the end? Because this is a horizontal motion, so it would probably have to be a vein, correct?
Yeah, the first sailboat design that I saw was a vertical seismometer. It moved up and down. The rod coming off the bottom of the boom, about halfway between the pivot point and the tip, went into a pot of oil that was sitting on the deck of the ship underneath, so to speak, and I presume that rod was moving a flat metal plate that was being pushed up and down in the oil. And to make that into a vein because you've got a horizontal displacing device, I think that's fairly easy to do. So the oil-type dash pot looks to me like you've got a lot of variables there where you can adjust the size of the oil pot, the thickness of the oil, the size of the vein, and whether or not the whole thing is near the pivot point or near the tip of the boom of the sailboat. So you got lots and lots of variables there. Some of the frequencies you're going to want to record are going to be super low frequencies. They're essentially direct current that's drifting, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And we can envision putting those super low frequencies into an analog to digital converter and then storing those digits. And that's a little bit hokey, doable. But another thing I believe is worth considering, and I've used this in the past, is a voltage-to-frequency converter. If the voltage coming out of your instrumentation is really the control voltage for a voltage-controlled oscillator, higher voltage gives you a higher pitch, lower voltage gives you a lower pitch. And so you've got a tone coming out of a tone generator proportional to the voltage coming out of your seismometer. And now you record that tone by way of a sound card. And the sound card will allow you to apply that music to your hard drive. And when you want to play it back, you dump the hard drive into your memory and then play back the memory at any speed you want. Once your music, your tones are in memory, you can play it fast and slow. And your human hearing will tell you right away if there's an event there and you know to slow down and pass back over that section again. And by the way, once you've got a voltage to frequency converter, know full well that there is the opposite. There is a frequency to voltage converter. So the actual voltage to bring it back into the original seismic very low frequency unit is relatively easy when you pass it back through a frequency to voltage converter. The frequency to voltage converter, it used to be a kind of a frequency discriminator, but modern-day digital processing, a DSP can easily give you each of these voltage-to-frequency and frequency-to-voltage conversions. So recording it as tones, as if it was music, and playing it back accordingly, I think gives you a lot...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I think that gives you a lot of knobs to twist on that piece of instrumentation, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, will the VCO be able to respond with these very low frequency drifts, or actually low voltage drifts?
The voltage to frequency converter I used when I was setting up my antenna range in the backyard would take a DC voltage and convert it to a tone. I could, if I want to, set it up as 0 volt is 0 hertz, and 10 volts is 10 kilohertz. So each volt is a kilohertz, if you know what I mean. You could set it up that way if you want to. Or you could set it up in a bidirectional manner, in other words, a bipolar manner. Minus 10 volts is 0 hertz, and plus 10 volts is 10 kilohertz. So you use the right kind of voltage-to-frequency converter. If the voltage sits at a constant 3 volts for the next hour, you get a continuous tone of 3 kilohertz for the next hour. That's very easy to record, and there's a one-to-one relationship between the two. This would be DC-coupled circuitry, not necessarily AC-coupled. I think you want DC-coupled circuitry because your voltages, when you finally get the thing working right, are going to be so low in frequency. Some of the ones that you care about are going to be so low in frequency, you can only preserve them if you've got low-drift electronics and everything is DC-coupled. That's a gut feel on my part. Over to you, John, K2RYW.
That makes a lot of sense. Also, you said your son may have had a couple of ideas that he went by. And, oh, by the way, I also tried to put this low frequency into my lock-in amplifier, the Applied Princeton Research amplifier, and that experiment didn't work out well, so I went back to what I was doing. But I was interested in what your son's comments were.
I'm going to have to interview my son a couple more times. He's pretty deep into computer networking and whatever, and recording techniques, occasionally. He used quite a few words that I didn't completely understand. I need an interpreter. he's got his master's degree in computer science and engineering science. Look out. and RF engineering. So he's deeper into some of the computer stuff than I am by a long shot. I didn't get a no from him when I talked about voltage to frequency converters, sound cards, recording tones, as if it was music. And when it comes to playing it back, you take the section of the hard drive that you care about, load it into your memory. Once it's into your RAM of your computer, now with the right kind of computer program, you can play it back at any speed you want. Speed it up, slow it down, increase the gain, decrease the gain, frequency, filter it, all kinds of... Well, once you've got it recorded in the various techniques that are quasi-analog, quasi-digital, I mean, your sound card, I guess it starts off quasi-analog, but it really does a kind of sampling of analog to digital conversion before recording, I think. So the old days where they didn't have anywhere near the electronics we got today, where they try to make massive pieces of electronics and a very delicate pen, and the pen literally moved across the piece of paper, and the paper represented extra drag, and maybe it was the damping factor. By modern-day standards, that's kind of crude. Oh, and you know that Mother Nature will dictate that the pen goes dry just before an earthquake happens, and so you don't record the data and so on. There's all kinds of nasty failure mechanisms, whereas a properly set up computer, properly recording the data, you can play it back with all kinds of increase and decrease of gain and frequency response and so on. So you've got a lot of ways of manipulating the data that you never had with a strip chart recorder. With the drum that's wound around, it recorded 5 tracks or 10 tracks across the drum, and then every day you had to record it, you had to replace that piece of paper. Life's a lot simpler these days as I see it. Over to you, John, K2RYW.
Exactly, Dick. That's why I've got a large 8 channel with a huge roll in it. I don't have to replace the paper often. But it's expensive to run, but it's well worth this effort. I'm having a lot of fun and learning a lot, too. Eventually, I'll probably find out what's going on. But I want to thank you for your help and everybody on the network here, because I've been getting a lot of the computer data information from people, and your help, too, and sending me in different directions. And it's coming to a point where it's coming together. So I'm very happy with this. And I hope to have more information next week. Maybe we can go a little further.
Out of curiosity, is Wes on a trip this week?
He's experienced some technical difficulties, which should be cured, I think, by tomorrow. I spoke to him again today. I don't know what his problem is over there, but he's going to have it corrected.
Okay. I'm going to leave you for now. This was TechNet number 1366. Cover series that began in September of 1982, 29 years ago. These people must be crazy. They keep coming back. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. And see you down the line. K2RIW, clear for listening.
K2RIW, K22QIQ. Before you go, Dick, I have a question for you.
Got it, Glenn.
Remember that 5/8 wave antenna I was talking about, dual stack, right now, this dual band, dual stack antenna? I have this one up on the roof now at about 25 feet, and I'm on an HT with a half a watt. I was wondering if you could actually hear me on the input.
Absolutely. You're running S2 on my input, and I'm not even running the preamp. And nice and loud, go ahead.
I'm beginning to like this antenna. I actually am in the works of a mobile version of it soon, so I'll keep you up on what's actually going on with it. 73 stick, I'll talk to you soon. K2RW, KC2QIQ. Have a good evening.
Yeah, for you to electrically measure the impedance from the tip of that base unit that feeds the end of the antenna, to measure that impedance with reference to your ground plane, that's a tricky measurement, but it can be done. That's what you really care about for figuring out where some of those bandwidth is coming from. But an easier way would be to take it apart, look at it, study it, measure it, possibly computer model it. And so that base unit is a big factor. The word antenna is a radiating device, an impedance matching device, and a transmission line, and a transmitter. And they all play together. That total radiating system, transmitter, transmission line, impedance matching device, radiator section. You have to resonate that whole system in order to radiate well. I think that's part of what goes on with acoustics. We intentionally look away from resonance with acoustics. That's part of why we're not getting some of the efficiencies we could be getting, in my opinion. But I'll be refining that opinion over the next few weeks. Bye-bye for now. Glenn, K2RIW.
73, KC2QIQ.
73, thank you, KC2FGV.
I'll copy. W2PVW, Whiskey 2, Tango Victor Whiskey, Sunnyside, Queens.
Copy, you're coming in. You're a little choppy, you're a little choppy. This is KC2JTK. Come back, come back.
Yeah, I'm here at this, the end of the train station. I had to get out from underneath that shield. I was kind of like under the rain guard, and I think that was blocking my signal, but this should be a little bit better. You're 5 and 9. You're loud and clear into the repeater, no problem.
You're coming through 100% right now. 100% right now, over.
All right. Very good. Fine business. I missed the train for this little QSO we're having here, but no big deal. I'll just wait for the next one.
Copy on that. I'd like to catch you one of these nights off of Queens Boulevard. Maybe get a little juice somewhere for a short time. Over.
Yeah, no problem. Sounds cool. Maybe one day you could stop by the job and maybe pick up something to eat. And there's a place. I told you, Kenny lives right down the block, right?
Copy. That's a copy. Is he out at this hour? Over.
Stand by a second. This is W2TVW for station ID.
KC2JGK. Holding.
Yeah, W2TVW. W2TVW calling KC2JGK.
Come back, W2KBW, this is KC2JGK, come back.
Yeah, can you give me a call in the cell? I seem to be having an issue, a little problem here I got to talk to you about.
Copy that, I'll try to hit the cell, just give me a minute, I'm out in the back, take me a couple of minutes to walk through into the house, over.
Next, tonight at 8.
ACTJGK, clear.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
W2KBW, this is KC2JGK, signing off.
The time is 1:23 a.m., 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Next tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Next tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Next tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Next tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
City B. Yo, yo, what's up?
Morning, Rich. Sound different, you on a different radio?